This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, Joe Biden has gotten the old leading from behind band back together, rolling out his national security team yesterday. Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Jake Sullivan, Hillary Clinton, who worked for Hillary Clinton at State for his national security advisor. And, well, here's what Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the selection for U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., had to say to Foreign Service personnel, to the nation, to the world.
I want to say to you, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. You excited that everything old is new again in a Biden administration?
I mean, sorry for interrupting. I just, you know, I didn't know America left. I didn't know diplomacy left for the past 5 years. Did you? Past 4 years? I wasn't aware of that. Because now everybody's flying their American flag, which they did not do for the last 4 years. But now it's cool to bring out the stars and stripes again.
Well, it was news to Mike Pompeo. He was on with our friend Brett Baer last night. And the incumbent Secretary of State, Pompeo, had this response to Ms. Thomas-Greenfield.
Where to begin, Brett? I remember what the previous administration did. They described leadership as leading from behind. President Trump never did that. We built out real coalitions, a coalition that crushed the caliphate in Syria, a coalition that's pushed back against the Chinese Communist Party, a coalition that refused to appease Iran. The list of work that we've done is great. What we said all along, Brett, and this is where I think I take a different path. I couldn't tell exactly from her statement, but multilateralism for the sake of hanging out with your buddies at a cool cocktail party, that's not in the best interest of the United States of America. We work with nations when we have common interests, and we develop coalitions that actually deliver real results and reflect the reality on the ground. That wasn't what was happening when we came in here to the State Department. We built out enormous teams. I'm proud of the work the State Department's done. We're going to continue to do that. It's our responsibility. So long as we have these offices, it's our duty to continue to deliver on American security, and we've done it well, and we'll continue to do so.
On a related note, Pompeo also went on to provide pushback to former Defense Secretary Mad Dog Mattis, who is a co-author of an op-ed suggesting it's time to leave America first behind, the Trump administration's principled realism policies, which is what it really was. But, of course, it's characterized, as it always is, by the internationalists as America alone. And Pompeo bristled at that characterization.
I have a lot of respect for Jim, but he's just dead wrong on that. America first has been at its heart a recognition that when America is secure at home, when America does good things for our own economy, for our own prosperity, that America will be a force for good all around the region, and that indeed we can't deliver security, increased security around the world when America is not secure. I take great umbrage of the fact it's been America alone. I would tell you that our Japanese colleagues, our South Korean colleagues, our Indian colleagues, our Australian colleagues all know that the pivot to Asia was a joke, but that the United States, under President Trump, actually delivered real benefits to them. And whether it was the work that we've done to build out an enormous coalition to go after the socialist Maduro, to go after the Cubans, these are real coalitions, real things that work. It wasn't America alone. It was us doing it with our friends and allies based on shared interest and a reality that recognized central facts about what is and not pretending that things are as we would like them to be.
This is just an extension of the Obama administration. It's nothing more.
That's what this is. It's living down to expectations, the Biden administration to be Obama era appointees implementing Comrade Bernie policies.
Yeah.
That's the track we're on. There's no question about it. Also something, too. My institutional memory is robust enough to recall how President Trump was the itchy trigger finger on the button. He was going to bring global thermonuclear war to the world. He was going to, you know, it was going to be some sort of Dr. Strangelove off-ramp, the Trump administration was, right? And of course, it's quite the opposite that's happened has over the last 4 years. I mean, and as he's going out the door, potentially, what do we have? We have
John Kerry is a
well, no,
czar.
But I mean, no. But Trump accomplished. What are we looking back at in terms of what Trump actually did versus how it's being characterized, and versus this, you know, return to normalcy, quote unquote, diplomacy, quote unquote, which for them is a synonym for appeasement. What do we have? We have the normalization. We talked about it yesterday a bit with the spokesman for the Saudi embassy. The normal. I mean, just of these accomplishments alone, the normalization of relationships. Between Israel and United Arab Emirates, between Israel and Bahrain, between Israel and Sudan, essentially stymieing of Iran in the region, the leading state sponsor of terror in the world, the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan. This was the warmonger in chief, I thought. This was somebody who was reckless, destabilizing.
Nobody wanted him carrying the football. Remember that?
In point of fact, it turns out, I think, if you reflect on the Trump years, and Pompeo did a pretty good job there, it seems to me that what Trump did was end the confusing of our enemies with our friends and end our friends taking advantage of us with just things that were largely symbolic but important.
Well, even with
rebalancing,
China.
Having them ante up for the shared security under NATO, for example.
Yeah, and pulling out of the WHO. I mean, he had an accomplished career, that's for sure. And I wanted to ask you about Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, because he worked with Hillary Clinton. He was her guy when she was at Secretary of State. And Obama's so excited about this one.
Wicked smart,
wicked.
Young, energetic, and... I think is going to be outstanding.
I mean, they went to Obama, former President Obama, to get reactions to these cabinet picks because he has more energy, can sell it better than actual President-elect Joe Biden can.
The coverage of the security team, national security team, is so interesting. David Harsanyi has a really good piece in National Review on this, and he pulls from the characterization of Anthony Blinken from The Guardian. This is just wonderful. This is what the D.C. press corps and their allies do to characterize. Whatever is going on the left is hip and cool and cosmopolitan, and whatever is going on the right is a bunch of slack-jawed yokels, the deplorables, the credulous boomer rubes. Right. So that's what they do here with Blinken, who, by the way, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State designee of Joe Biden. This is how one John McCain.
Oh,
John McCain, Senator John McCain, the revered John McCain, when it comes to somebody attacking Republicans, that's when he's revered. When it was this John McCain, not so revered, the occasion of Anthony Blinken's nomination as Deputy Secretary of State during the Obama years.
I will tend to do what I can to prevent this nominee from being confirmed by the United States Senate. He's unqualified. He has refused to answer simple and fundamental questions that I had for him.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I hope during the confirmation hearing, if that's what comes to pass, that quote from John McCain is played for Mr. Blinken. Maybe we could revisit what concerned John McCain in 2014 when it was an appointment to be Deputy Secretary of State. So back to Harsanyi and this characterization of Pompeo and Blinken. This is from The Guardian, but it could be the Amazon Post. It could be the New York Times. It could be any of these. I mean, it probably will be cut and paste.
Yeah, that's all they do. They're lazy.
While Mike Pompeo has remained a domestic politician throughout his tenure as Secretary of State, giving the lion's share of his interviews to conservative radio stations in the Midwest, for example.
Oh, no.
Terrible.
Not the big bad Midwest. Oh, my God.
Blinken is very much a born internationalist. He went to school in Paris, where he learned to play the guitar. He played Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall at graduation. He played football,
say that,
parentheses, soccer, and harbored dreams of becoming a filmmaker. Before entering the White House under Barack Obama, he used to play in a weekly soccer game with U.S. officials, four diplomats, and journalists. He has two singles, love songs titled Lip Service and Patience, uploaded on Spotify. His turn-ons include this and his turn...
Wait, does he like late night walks on the beach and sushi?
This continues. This is a news piece in The Guardian. All those contacts and the urbane bilingual charm will be targeted at soothing the frayed nerves of Western allies, reassuring them that the U.S. is back as a conventional team player. The foreign policy priorities of the first days of a Biden administration will be rejoining treaties and agreements that Donald Trump left. That is a news story in The Guardian.
It sounds like it's on Match.com or something, you know? He's a fun guy. He's talented and musical. Is.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have a super fun first date. Yeah. I'll pack a picnic basket. I mean, we go sailing. Here's David Harsanyi responding to that, too. It's even funnier. No longer will our foreign policy elites play to the boorish, slack-jawed yokels who listen to AM radio and watch football, parentheses, football, in Kansas City. Blinken, cosmopolitan polyglot, will kick around soccer balls with well-bred diplomats on weekends, and on weekdays he will rejoin treaties and agreements ratified by the European Union and China, but not by the United States Senate. We are indeed headed back to Obama-era normalcy. Isn't this fun?
We play a riff on his guitar during his Senate confirmation hearings.
So cool. God, he's so cool.
He's smart, man. He's a young, whippersnapper.
I want to be Anthony Blinken. So bad. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving, guys. I just see a greater, on the domestic policy, I see this greater nexus of government and big tech with some of these appointments that I've seen him put in already. Foreign policy is going to go back to the Obama era. These guys, like this Blinken guy, is absolutely just milquetoast. And we're going to go back to selected overthrows of regimes and droning people and putting our foot in, but not everything going in. It's just scary. Our enemies have to be licking their chops. James Lindsay identified this on a couple of your interviews on your show. It's going to be this critical race theory coming back. And don't be confused about these people at the top that have got the squad upset. The squad's going to do their damage at the lower levels of bureaucracy and start filling in all these other bureaucratic positions with a bunch of apparatchiks that push their agenda. This administration is going to lead to more interventionism. It's going to lead to a terrible economy. It's going to be more taxes, more oppression, and it's going to lead to a greater nexus between big government and tech, just like Joel Kotkin mentioned. This is really scary, and I just want to warn everybody that this is what you get when you vote for people like Biden. This is what you get.
Thanks.
And it's not going to get better.
Thanks for the call, Greg. John in Bridgeport. Oh, sorry.
Or Mike.
Hey, guys.
Morning. Hold on a second. Hold on. Let's try that again. John in Bridgeport.
Hey, guys. Just three things here. One, they're back at it again, the anarchists at Archer and Western. They tried taking down the McKinley Park statue again overnight. So I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do to fix this.
Call Lori Lightfoot. She'll have it removed.
But after her steak
and scotch.
I'm not
so sure on that. Number two, is it Obama that's pulling the strings on all this, in your humblest opinion? And three, what's going on with the Oberweis race there? What's your gut instinct on that? Let me know. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John. With respect to Obama, is Obama pulling strings? I like Harsanyi's characterization of this as the blob. This is just the liberal internationalists restaking their claim, retaking power, and Obama's included in there, of course. So it's not just calling the shots. I mean, they're all part and parcel of the same shot. You know what I mean? There's no need to it because they are sharing one brainwave. Number one, with respect to Oberweis, I haven't seen any updates on.
He hasn't conceded.
I know that.
But
I haven't seen any updates
on the recount.
I haven't seen any updates on that.
But
I know
he's 5,000 behind right now. I'm looking at the totals.
It seems unlikely that turns out in his favor.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And before the break, we were talking about Joe Biden's national security team that he rolled out yesterday, and just the transition in general. Oh, by the way, all of the caterwauling about the transition.
Yeah.
Well, that's all subsided now.
Okay.
Everything is hunky dory. So, you know, for 5 seconds, the fate of the Republic hung in the balance because Joe Biden wasn't on his timeline, his desired timeline. Now, Joe Biden telling Lester Holt, everything's fine.
And there's a lot of immediate discussion. And I must say, the outreach has been sincere. There's not been begrudging so far. And I don't expect it to be. So, yes, it's already begun.
And there was even talk. Yeah, there even talk that he might put a Republican member as a cabinet member.
Do we have to go through this like we have pretend we've never gone through this before? This is like Bill Clinton making Bill Cohen his Secretary of Defense. That's some signal of bipartisanship. LaHood during
Obama,
the Obama years.
Transportation Secretary.
All you would have there is somebody who essentially was selling out who they said they were in order to get a high-profile post.
Right. What about Chris Christie or Adam Kinzinger? What positions are they applying for?
I don't know, but what do you think that accomplishes? You think that is a unifying event? No. That whoever that person may or may not be would immediately be dismissed out of hand, but Biden said, oh, by the way, that's not in the offing anytime soon.
Have you considered, for the sake of national unity, selecting or nominating a Republican, someone who voted for President Trump?
Yes, and we still have a lot more appointments to make. I want this country to be united. The purpose of our administration is, once again, united. We can't keep this virulent political dialogue going. It has to end.
Should we expect an announcement?
No.
Not ever or not soon?
No, not soon.
Yeah,
stringing them along.
This has got to end. I'm certainly considering it. Should we expect it? No, absolutely not.
And then,
not in the near term.
Biden also told Holt, you know, that this isn't an extension of the Obama administration. No,
this is not a third Obama term, because we face a totally different world than we faced in the Obama Biden administration. President Trump has changed the landscape. It's become.
Yeah, I'm already going to my happy place.
It's the same people going further left, and it's the same rhetoric that you heard from the Obama-Biden administration about the George W. Bush administration. Right? It's changed the landscape and all the repairing of relationships we need to do and so on and so forth. By the way, just on this transition thing, you know, in case you hear the peaceful transfer of power, something that was not afforded President Trump, as we well know, but is being afforded, at least in process, pending these election challenges to President-elect Biden. Pompeo saying the same thing with Brett Baer. You know, we'll do what's required.
Today we began the process to see what GSA's decision was, and we'll do everything that's required by law. We'll make this work.
So everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, if people could tamp down your leftist friends, to the extent you have leftist friends, could tamp down their hyperventilating for 5 seconds, the ridiculousness, the chicken littles that they are. John Kerry also introduced yesterday, because climate is a national security issue.
Yeah, he's the seat at the table. A seat at the table. Can you believe that?
It's a worthwhile question to say, if it's a national security issue, why isn't it something that Anthony Blinken can handle? Why do you need a czar? Obviously, it's window dressing. That's all John Kerry's ever been.
President Joe Biden will trust in God, and he will also trust in science to guide our work on Earth to protect God's creation. Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden, a man of God and science, like the Holy Roman Empire, which was neither holy nor Roman. And I always have to ask with John Kerry, hey, why the long face?
Oh, hey. But this is a very important job. I mean, this is Biden explaining this job that Kerry's going to have.
World War Zero, meaning that the ultimate war to save the world is getting to zero emissions.
Yeah. He's got a big job ahead of him.
China is licking their chops at John Kerry's first visit, because they will happy to lie to him. And that's all you really need to do to get what you want with John Kerry, as the Iranians figured out. You'll remember he negotiated the nuclear surrender deal to Iran. John Kerry will show up. He'll extract promises for emissions reductions from the Chinese. And in return, he'll let the Chinese have their way with Taiwan, the South China Sea, probably the insinuation of Huawei to build our 5G network before it's all said and done if it's left to John Kerry. I would rather send Dennis Rodman to negotiate a nuclear non-proliferation deal with Kim Jong-un than John Kerry to negotiate with the Chinese. I mean, it's comical. Also comical, our old mayor, Tiny Dancer, is running into some static for the post that he seeks. You know, he wants to be transportation secretary.
Yeah.
But that's running into some roadblocks, including from the Socialist Spice Girls and their front woman, AOC. What is so hard to understand about this, she tweeted. Rahm Emanuel helped cover up the murder of Laquan McDonald. Covering up a murder is disqualifying for public leadership. This is not about the quote-unquote visibility of a post. It is shameful and concerning that he is even being considered. And she's talking about being considered now for U.S. Trade Representative rather than Secretary of Transportation because of this Laquan McDonald problem he has with the left.
Oh, my gosh. That's going to follow with him. Progressives are 0-7 right now, just in case you're keeping score. Because Warren's out as Secretary of Treasury.
I don't think they're 0-7 when you have something called a climate czar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He wasn't curious, wasn't on their list, but all right, maybe they're 1-6. Fine.
Well, although they are very active, not just AOC and the gals trying to tube Rahm Emanuel, but Black Lives Matter in L.A. Trying to tube Eric Garcetti. Eric Garcetti, the mayor there, also rumored for Secretary of Transportation, maybe because Tiny Dancer has fallen down a few pegs. But Black Lives Matter wants the administration to know Eric Garcetti, he's no good.
Garcetti.
I want to be real clear what he's attempted to do for his entire reign as mayor. Is silence black voices.
Right. Get him.
We will not let our voices be silent.
Get him.
We will not let our voices be silent. He wants us to be silent as he continues to feed a police department that is one of the most murderous in the entire nation.
Didn't they defund LAPD about $150 million?
Well, I mean, what is that in the grand scheme of things for what Black Lives Matter wants? That was F.U. Garcetti, that little F.U. Garcetti rally. That was outside his home.
Okay. I hope it wasn't a group of 10 or more because that's illegal in California.
Of course. Yeah, no, of course.
They better have been wearing masks, too.
Also, this, since we're on the topic of Black Lives Matter and their continued ascendancy, in the event you thought they were going away, Patrice Cullors, the Marxist co-founder of Black Lives Matter, writing a missive to Biden and Kamala Harris saying, in short, black people won this election. We want something for our vote. We want to be heard and our agenda to be prioritized. What is their agenda? Well, they put it on their website before they took it down, so it's pretty straightforward. Among other things, Patrice Cullors also said that abolishing prisons would be a good start. Pushing for quote-unquote modern-day civil rights legislation. She proposed the bill, the BREATHE Act. Practically speaking, the BREATHE Act is a landmark civil rights bill. It takes bold, progressive steps to build public safety systems that work for all of us, no matter what community we come from. We need funds to create public safety systems uniquely tailored to the community's needs and incentivize states to decarcerate and defund. So, again, don't be so myopic and just thinking about defunding police. You also have to think about decarcerating prisoners and defunding the prison system. Okay. All right.
Sounds like an America I want to live in.
Hitting the ground running. Tom in Deer Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan and Amy, good morning. Dan, I wanted to ask you, Garcetti, he's cannon fodder. Nobody cares about him. But with AOC getting under Tiny Dancer's burn, his saddle, so to speak, do you see him getting retribution short, medium, or
That's interesting. You know, I don't know. Thanks for the call, Tom. Would Tiny Dancer try to orchestrate a primary against her? One of the things, remember, we're in a redistricting phase now. And there had been rumors prior to the election that AOC is not particularly popular in Dem socialist circles in New York. Since New York is going to lose a congressional seat, what if the seat they lost was AOC's? That probably
would be the
quicker and less difficult path to compromising her political future. But also, too, don't forget, she was so despondent just a couple weeks ago. She was contemplating, you know, just leaving politics. It's just not all that she thought it was cracked up to be. And so, you know, she just has, you know, so many pressures on her. And this, of course, is where people, please, this is where she wants people to beg her to stay. No, please don't leave.
No, don't, we need you.
Right.
The party needs you.
Exactly. But I think the redistricting play could be the play for those who may want to put a bit of stick about on AOC.
But does she have that much power that she's really going to stop Rahm Emanuel from getting that U.S. trade rep position?
No, she raises the profile and she enlists, you know, all of the other identitarians to get after Tiny Dancer. And isn't that just so fitting? Hoist by his own petard. This is somebody who countenanced the identitarians throughout his political career, really fostered their ascendancy within the Democrat Socialist Party. And were he to be taken out from a desired post by them, that's called karma. Mike in Union.
Good morning. Earlier, when you were reading the bio for this Anthony Blinken, I swear it was a communist promotion group that was, you know, I was waiting for them to say that maybe he rides his horse, you know, with no shirt on or got 18 holes at one the last time he was out golfing. You also asked earlier about Trump. And
yeah, by the way, it's funny you say that because it was very reminiscent of the New York Times hagiography on Adolf Hitler as a Bavarian gentleman. Back in the 30s. Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And Adonis. Yeah, and then when you asked about Trump and his successes, I think one of the successes was he didn't listen to the insiders. He brought people in from the outside who were already successful financially and didn't need to get a government job to become millionaires. And then lastly, I think Hunter Biden would make a great trade secretary, since he's got so much experience between the Chinese and the Ukrainians and everything else. So,
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, I don't know if maybe we could suspend our concern about nepotism because of Hunter Biden's experience with business dealings with our enemies and make him the Commerce Secretary, for example, or U.S. Trade Rep. Yeah, I like that. I like that. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan. Have a happy Thanksgiving, by the way. Kerry gave an interesting statistic yesterday. 13% of global climate change is caused by the U.S. That's unbelievably low. And how much are we going to be able to correct it? He has to go after China, who is building hundreds of fossil fuel plants. They build more fossil fuel plants, China does, than the rest of the world combined. I wonder how he's going to solve the climate change problem when the rest of the world is polluting, not us.
Uh-huh. Thanks for the call, Bob. Dave in Southwest Michigan.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I've been saying before, early in the pandemic, that the puppet master was Nancy Pelosi, but leading into the election, I can't help but wonder if our real shadow president is Obama running the strings. And what do you think?
Well, thanks for the call, Dave. As I said, I don't I mean, you know, there's involvement, but, you know, they've got a lot on their plate. They have to produce a bunch of things for Netflix. Obama's got to record, you know, whatever his 42-volume series on his life and times. You know, they got a lot of things to do.
Michelle said no to a cabinet position because they were.
Oh.
I'm just letting you know she put her foot down, Dan, and.
Yeah.
You're not going to let him do that.
Right. This is the thing. There's no need for shadows. There's no need for shadowy figures. They're sharing a brainwave, right? You don't need it. They're going to bring in the same people to advance the same positions. They're just harder and faster left than they were 12 years ago. That's all. This is Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Michelle Weldon is a professor emerita from Northwestern University. Of course she is. And guess which discipline?
What?
Journalism. Medill. Oh. Writing in Huffington Post, the professor says, "I love you, but I do not want to die because of your good time. Not that I'm opposed to your personal enjoyment. I'm all for recreation, within reason, of course. But the eschewing of caution, throwing it all to the wind in order to hang out with your friends and laugh for a few hours, stand near each other, drink, eat, well, it's just too reckless for me because you will come home and breathe on me." This is an open letter to her three sons.
Oh, so she's not letting her sons come home for Thanksgiving?
No, she is, but I don't know why they'd want to go.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Can you repeat that?
She is, but I don't know why her sons would want to go. Apparently, two of them live at home. Now that two of you are living back home because of COVID-19, and there is room for all of us, and you're welcome here, of course. I'm sure they feel it. It becomes my business where you go and what you do on the weekends, and when your middle brother comes home to visit for Thanksgiving, we all need to be vigilant. You are my sons, and I love all three of you, but this takes priority. I understand many around the country feel and act the same way you do, especially young men in your 20s and 30s. You feel an immunity to the reality of COVID-19 contagion and consequence. I am relieved all three of you are out of high school and college because as athletes, you would have likely insisted you compete. I would not have gone along with parents like the ones who recently attempted to sue the Illinois High School Association so fall sports could resume. The common sense gap is not generational, but perhaps informational and emotional. An empathy gap about how personal actions lead to communal reactions and harm. Did I fail to model that? Or did you miss the key point? The blue bowl of masks and plastic gloves by the phone in the breakfast room and the hand sanitizer in almost every room of the house are not for show. These are because this pandemic is real, even if you don't think it will happen to you or me. Of course you love me, I'm your mom, and I love you always. I'm not so sure if it is denial, lack of understanding, or blocking out worst-case scenario thinking, but at this address, I'm the only one in the family who is wearing a mask when the Amazon delivery person drops off another package that one of you ordered.
I mean, she's got to be divorced, right?
Don't know. Just to be clear, we're not doing the usual Thanksgiving this year with all your favorite cousins. I know you adore them, but maybe we can Zoom. I'm happy you will be home for Thanksgiving in this house. I ordered a small turkey, and we'll make most, not all, of the sides of the four of us. But I'm a little skittish. We can sit 6 feet apart, maybe. I may wear a mask, yes, even indoors. Risk averse, I guess you would call me, but I'm not so sure it's a bad thing to be now, because what if you're wrong? What if the chance you take is not just an exercise in free will and asserting your right to enjoy yourself, but a decision that harms someone other than you? What if that someone is me, your mom? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. There is no guilt like the layering on of motherly guilt on a son, is there?
No. I mean, she's not well-read. She doesn't know the science and the data. Her kids have a better chance of getting struck by lightning than dying from COVID. And I don't know what her age group is or if she has a comorbidity, but she needs to relax and she needs to read up on the latest science and data. Kids are not super spreaders like we thought they were. And the sports thing, yeah. So not shaming moms who've let their kids play sports, because my kids have been playing sports, well, one of them, since June 1st, every weekend, and one practice a week. Basketball. Oh, how dare we? How can we put our kids' lives in danger like that?
Well, she's a Northwestern, the professor emerita at Medill. So let's talk about Illinois, because we've done it all right. We have men and women of science and data, people that are just as risk-averse, people that live worst-case scenario in this with respect to COVID-19, not any other aspect of their life, because that's not how people live. Game planning for worst-case scenario and saying, if this is possible, then I won't do anything. That's not how people live, but this is how she suggests we live under COVID. Illinois has had a mask mandate since May 1st.
Yep.
$5 million ad campaign to encourage mask wearing. Closed indoor dining and bars at the end of October again. Stay-at-home advisory in Chicago and additional statewide restrictions enacted last week. And so how could it be that Illinois enjoys this designation? No other state in the nation has ever averaged 12,000 cases a day for a whole week. Illinois did that last week.
Oh, yeah.
Not even Florida with 1.7 times the population. Not even California with 3 times the population. Or Texas with 2.3 times the population. Illinois, 12,000 cases a day for a whole week. Because we're doing everything right. I mean, the politicians are. It's the families. It's Illinois residents that are failing. How could that be?
Well, keep in mind, too.
If we've done everything right. So we're told we're ahead of the learning curve. We have instituted some of the most draconian shutdown policies a couple of times now over the last 8 months. How could Illinois enjoy this designation or not enjoy this designation as you know, more accurately?
Well, we have more
for
cases
per capita.
I know, deaths per capita. What is it? Well, we've had 125 deaths a day for the past 3 days. Big what? But we've also tested.
We tested because of what?
We're testing more. We've 12 million people in Illinois. So far, there have been 10.2 million tests. That's what they said yesterday, that have been people
Florida has done 22% more tests than Illinois has done, and they have 15%. Their death per capita is 15% lower.
So what are we doing wrong?
Nope. Illinois has exceeded the peak deaths in Florida twice, once in May and once again now. And so why is this not news? This is what Yu-Yang Gu, who is a MIT graduate, he's also the creator of COVID-19-projections.com. You know, he's not a man of science or data. He's just an MIT flunky. He's not somebody smart and visionary like Pritzker or Lightfoot. How could this be? I want to know. And by the way, where is the media? Where are all your friends? In the Chicago Press Corps and the national media. There is no national outlet covering the situation in Illinois, as Mr. Gu points out in this Twitter thread that I retweeted at Dan Proft. You can check out. Illinois reported 15,415 cases in a single day last week, more than Florida ever did in a single day. And many of you probably don't know the dire situation in Illinois. That's because no mainstream media outlet chooses to report it. And I've given you the other data, comparison of states with much more population. We hear a lot, Mr. Gu goes on, we hear a lot of talk about how the deaths in Florida were preventable. What about the ones in Illinois? I tried to search for discussions on what went wrong in Illinois or whether we could have mitigated, prevented the situation. Couldn't find much. Why do you think that is? Jennifer in Matson.
What a bunch of hi, Jennifer. Joyless... What a joyless group of people, honestly, these libs. Yes. And I always say, liberals, where fun goes to die. Matt.
Like a Jennifer. T-shirt.
Well,
most of our deaths are in...
Ron on the south side's position.
Oh. Hey, Ron. Good morning, guys. You know, hello?
Yeah.
Hello? Yeah, real quick.
Yeah, Ron.
You know,
go ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah. I agree with the article. You know, guys, I listen every day, and what I hear about is, well, my freedom is being taken away. As if to imply that we are just totally free to do everything that we desire. And just want it sounds immature and childish. It really does.
No, you know, actually, it's the opposite, Ron. Ron, I love you, but that's not the argument at all. It's not the argument at all.
Okay,
you're free to do whatever you want regardless of consequence. That's not the argument. The argument is the policies that you're instituting, their impact, and their opportunity cost. We've just gone through what the impact is, which is Illinois is doing one of the worst jobs in the country based on their own metrics, based on their metrics, not mine, their metrics. Number one. Number two, at what cost? At what cost in terms of lives and livelihoods? The opportunity costs of focusing all health care resources on COVID to the exclusion of other maladies. The real costs imposed on businesses and people's livelihoods, and how that has negative health effects, as we know, as is documented. This is not in controversy. In addition to the unintended consequences for people's health with respect to mental health and other issues. So you have to take it all in and say, is this the best policy choice we could be making? And the evidence suggests it's perhaps the worst policy choice we could be making.
Okay. You know what? I'll think about it.
No, thanks, Ron.
All right.
Think about it over Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Ron.
But the problem is nursing homes.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Nursing homes and assisted living centers. I mean, the 27 people died at the VA in LaSalle, and I watched that they had a Senate hearing yesterday, and the director, Chapa LaVia, she never informed Governor Pritzker that there was an outbreak. And they also let people who were infected back into work because they had a staffing shortage. So I know they're doing an internal investigation, but that's where this problem is. And if you look at DuPage County, 71% of the most recent deaths all came from assisted living or nursing homes.
You really want to put your lives, your life and the lives of those you love in the hands of these people? I mean, it was just a couple of years ago we had the Legionnaires' disease outbreak in veterans' mm-hmm. homes where a bunch of veterans died that didn't need to die if there had been better administration of the veterans' homes.
And then Ronner and his wife moved in for a week and made everything all better.
And now it's this. I mean, it's just stunning to me. There is willful blindness with respect to what we're presenting here. Willful blindness. I refuse to contemplate it. I'm going to put my gloves and I'm going to put my face mask on, and I'm going to moralize to my sons.
I'm going to shut businesses down where they're not even super spreading events. I'm going to shut sports down where there's study after study. I have a stack here.
You're beating the disease. You're locking down COVID, as Joe Biden said, right? Is that what you think you're doing, Miss Weldon, and others? Nate in Bridgeport.
Hey, my neighbor won't. She's got kids in the house, and she won't wear a mask. Can I call DCFS on her?
I think it's a Chicago police call. I think they have rapid response teams at the ready. Thanks for the call, Nate.
Well, and just so you know, speaking of police, I asked Lightfoot yesterday, or excuse me, Mayor Lightfoot, about those 2,000 city employees. You know, what are their jobs going to be on Thanksgiving?
We're not going door to door to break up house parties. But let me say this, the advice that Dr. Rorty and other public health officials have given. While we are starting to see some glimmer of light, I want to remind people.
Yeah, not to have their parties, because a virtual Thanksgiving or an ICU Christmas, that's the new hashtag, Dan.
No, I know. Thanksgiving, prologue to death.
Yeah.
This week on the Hallmark Channel. Pat in Lockport.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment that woman that's so afraid about seeing her son, I think it's absolutely ridiculous. Number two, if anybody thinks that I'm going to give some self-designated dictator the right to tell me how to celebrate with my family on a holiday, you got another thought coming. The most vulnerable person at our get-togethers is going to be me. I'm in my mid-70s. And you know what? We're all going to die of something. I could get creamed by a semi the day after Thanksgiving, and then I would have given up seeing my grandchildren on Thanksgiving. It's not going to happen. The response to this pandemic, which is serious, I admit, is insane. And I think the homeless are the smartest people in the world, because evidently they have perfected herd immunity, mm-hmm. because their conditions that they live in are deplorable. I'm surprised they haven't run out of body bags picking these people up if this is so fatal.
Well, so, Pat, are you going to be wearing a mask around your grandkids?
Hell no.
Okay.
Hell no.
Are you going to have the window open for proper ventilation? Sit six
Hell
feet
no,
apart?
I'll be
have
too
one
chilly.
Sliver? Okay.
Nope. We're all bringing food. We are going to sit down and we are going to thank Almighty God for the gifts that we have. And I know we're only semi-free in this country, but I'm going to make the most of the free part and the hell with these dictators.
Thanks.
I'm sorry,
call.
But that's I'm done. I'm just done.
Right, it's your choice. Call, it's your choice what you do in your home. Yep.
I love Pat's spirit. That's a little bit more of the American spirit that we're missing. Heather McDonald writing in The Spectator. Today we are strangling American society in order to avoid a risk of death so infinitesimal, roughly 0.001%. For the majority of Americans, that would not have registered in any possible cost-benefit analysis governing both notable American endeavors and quotidian activities over the last four centuries. Our current Thanksgiving Day mantras, stay with your pod, stay within your bubble, stay within your household. Don't travel. Don't share food. Don't touch your family members or friends. Speak only in hushed tones.
Don't sing.
Make a mockery of the spirit that creates a country and sustains human life. This present moment is less like that first Thanksgiving celebration and more like the Salem witch frenzy of 1692. Mm-hmm. John on the West Side.
Hi, Dan. Amy. I go through my routine every day. I don't stop. Nothing's changed for me in 8 months. I don't know anyone in my community that has been sick or died. I don't understand this.
Well, it's real, and people have died. And Dan, you and I both know someone in the ICU on a ventilator and has been for a long time. But, you know, people need to read about what group and age group it's affecting. And if you have a comorbidity, I think those are the people, and we've said this several times, those are the people who should shelter in place if they so choose to, and then let everybody else live their lives. Reopen Illinois, because it's not working.
Paula in Batavia. Hi, Paula.
Paula.
Yeah, good morning. Oh, can you hear me okay?
Yep, go ahead. Go ahead, Paula.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, go ahead, Paula.
You know, I think that what we're all forgetting is that our cases were declining. And actually, last night I was looking, and at the end of October it was 7,800. And then it went all the way down to 5,700. And then the state decided that they were going to recalculate how they call new cases. And instead of it being just people that are tested positive, it's also people that could potentially have COVID. Mm-hmm. And you can look at the Illinois Department of Health site. They tell you that started on November 6th. At that point, they reported 10,000 cases. And then on the 7th, they reported over 12,000 cases.
Yeah.
So I think that the cases that they're reporting, I mean, really? Can I even believe those numbers?
Well, the CDC changed the rules. They changed the rules. So a touchdown used to be 6 points. A touchdown now is 12 points because they're adding antigen tests and probable possible cases to their count.
I think we need to take this approach and just say, as long as any of us has COVID, we all have COVID. We are all infected. The number of cases in Illinois is 12.8 million. We all have COVID. As long as one of our brothers or sisters has COVID, we all have COVID. How about that? Just make it simple. Okay. Cut to the chase. Victor at Midway.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The last caller was exactly right, and I'm so disgusted with these tyrant leaders we have in our state. And honestly, I'm kind of disappointed in our own citizens, the minority few who actually believe this, because let me tell you something. My aunt has been a virologist for 27 years. She works alongside other virologists and other doctors, and I've been calling the radio station for over 8 months now, and if people actually look into the medical book, any medical book, it's listed as a common cold. And yes, if you have a comorbidity, you have to avoid getting a cold or a seasonal flu. That could be deadly for you also. So what is wrong with people's common sense?
Yeah, it's common sense has gone out the window. But it's true. And that the woman who called, who's going to have her grandkids over, that's her choice. And hopefully, you know, wash your hands, the whole basic thing that we know we're doing.
Frank in Franklin Park.
Yeah, you know, the left and the liberals rallying cry when AIDS first came out and, you know, gay rights was, don't tell us what to do in our bedrooms. Don't tell us what to do in our houses. Now they're telling us what to do in our houses. Isn't that kind of ironic?
Very. Thanks, Frank. David in Lansing.
Come on, man. It's time to come together. I stole your vote with inclusive and extensive voter fraud organization in history. I'm going to take your guns. I'm going to double your taxes. Gasoline's going to double. I'm going to turn your neighbor into a rat against you. Maybe I want you to take chemicals, or maybe you can't travel. It's going to be a long, dark winter. So come on, let's come together. Or domestic terrorists, Antifa will burn down your business. Or maybe BLM will come to your house and protest on your lawn. So come on, man, let's come together. Come
on, you must be on Biden's transition team. Thanks for the call, David. Appreciate that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
I'm winning, Santana.
Yeah.
I got something right, Dan.
It's impressive. Whisper that in your ear.
No, he didn't. I swear to God, Justin did not help me cheat.
That's very good. I'm sorry, I was distracted.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Rule of thumb for journalists. Rule of thumb for journalists when it comes to reporting in general, perhaps COVID specifically. This from Holman Jenkins at the Wall Street Journal. When you find yourself trying to peddle emotion, stop. When you catch yourself selecting facts and claims and metaphors for their sentimental wallop rather than intellectual merit, rethink. The public needs information and context, not help milking its tear ducts. He's offering those rules of the road, if you will, for journalists because of an NPR report that marked another grim milestone. You know, Rachel, each of these terrible new milestones is so big they can start to feel incomprehensible. So I've been struggling to find a way to put such a terrible tragedy into some kind of context. It's hard, but 250,000 deaths is about five times the number of U.S. troops killed in combat in Vietnam. It's nearly five times the number of Americans who died in combat in World War I. Jenkins writes, those words were spoken with the dramatic intonation that NPR apparently now requires of its on-air performers, indicating not informational content, but somebody's idea of an appropriate emotional response to be extorted from listeners. And yet the question that started the discussion could have been answered in another way, more befitting a news organization. 250,000 deaths is 9% more than the estimated U.S. death toll from the 1957 flu, adjusted for population. It's 34% larger than the 1968 flu's death toll. It's about one-fifth of the 1918 pandemics. Jenkins writes, at least our reporter didn't tell us that laying the victims end-to-end would reach from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. Right. It's not like heart disease, which kills an estimated 655,000 Americans a year and will likely continue doing so for the foreseeable future. Why not educate your audience? Holman Jenkins asks, somewhat rhetorically, but he does it anyway. It begins with natural selection. Unknown millions of virus types exist in the world. The number of individual viruses believed to be 10 times the number of biological cells. A liter of seawater contains about 10 billion viruses. Viruses are a major driver, perhaps the key driver, of genetic ferment in the biosphere. Some 20 to 40% of all bacterial cells in the ocean die from viral infection each day. We wouldn't be here without this giant, complicated mixmaster. It's a tragedy for humanity when a new deadly virus comes into the world, leaving a noticeable imprint on the mortality tables, accounting for 9% of all U.S. deaths this year. Unlike car accidents and opioid overdoses, however, COVID deaths are likely to be much reduced next year. Human immune systems will adapt. Vaccines will be deployed. We get invaluable help, which our ancestors never received, from science to endure this new threat from nature as we continue the activities necessary for human survival and advancement. the idea that going from COVID deaths of 24999 to 25000 is a milestone is the hoariest kind of fake news, writes Jenkins. And isn't it, though? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend and award-winning investigative journalist, Cheryl Atkinson. Cheryl, thanks so much for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Good to join you.
So what about that? I love the Jenkins, you know, rules of the road for journalists. It actually calls to mind, and it was noted on his passing, Jim Lehrer's, like, 20 rules that he had for how he conducts himself as a journalist. And it basically comported with what Jenkins writes here. If you're trying to peddle emotion, if you're trying to select facts to elicit an emotional response from your audience rather than provide context and consequence, then just stop it.
Well, and I think that's absolutely correct. But I think there's more to it. And this is really what my new book, Slanted, takes a look at, what it's all about, is why this information landscape has changed so much and been transformed from, I think, what we used to think of as journalism and how it was practiced to this almost unrecognizable place where reporters seem to think it's their job now to make you feel a certain way, preferably in their view, feel how they do or their corporate and political interests feel about a certain topic. And I think even what's worse, we've seen the idea embraced by many people that now these third parties, political and corporate interests, are supposed to get between us and our information, make sure we don't see certain things, certain scientific studies, certain views that they've decided are wrong, particularly because they cut against their interest, their money interest. But that's what's behind it. But we're told that they're just fact-checking for us or they're just curating our information. And I think this is a really dangerous place where journalism is today. And it's bled over these narratives and special interests that have largely started to control the news, have bled over into big tech and social media because they understood people were still getting their unfettered access to information online and weren't being controlled. So that had to be stopped. And I think that's the stage we've moved into now.
But you know, a lot of people watch cable news still, and I felt like media bias is exacerbated by Trump's presidency. And why is that? Is because he tried to kick reporters out of the room? Boy, I'm just trying to wrap my head around it.
President Trump is viewed by powerful interests as uniquely dangerous as an outsider. So the money trains that they had set up, both Democrats, Republicans, and corporations, to influence politics and everything that happened, meant very little once Trump was get elected. It shook up everything. So these narratives and these interests got busy, the ones who pull strings, the smear industry, as I call it, crisis PR firms, nonprofits, LLCs, political action committees, the same ones that pull strings and get their talking points put on the news. They thought this was a terrible development. They got busy trying to controversialize this president, make sure he could get as little done as possible. And the news invited, as I describe in Slanted, the news embraced it and invited themselves to be used as narrative machines by inviting these political and corporate interests into our newsrooms. Now they are us. These same people that used to influence us, they're employed as reporters and editors and executives in newsrooms. So if you understand news today redefined in this climate, not as getting at the truth, but making sure we don't see the full truth, then you can understand why they do what they do and why they're rewarded for it, even when they're wrong, when the reporting is bad and false, but nobody's really held accountable. It's because that's exactly what they wanted to do, was get across a particular narrative, true or not, usually not true or at least skewed. And that's the goal now, making sure you don't get all of the facts and all sides.
You referenced this dangerous place that we're in, and I want to get your viewpoint on where you think this is going. And I highlight a couple of things to build on what you were saying. Bob Epstein, the Harvard-trained psychologist on Tucker Carlson's show the other night, saying, this is somebody who's been researching Google for a long time in terms of their ability to manipulate information and thus influence votes. He looked at it in 2016. He looked at it in 2020. Said Google moved at a minimum of 6 million votes in the 2020 election based on his research through their manipulation of search algorithms. Report out that Facebook also altered a prioritization score to downgrade outlets like Breitbart and upgrade outlets like CNN in the closing days of the election so that people would get the information that that Facebook wanted people to get in their news feeds. There's that, and then there's the response even from the quote-unquote mainstream journalistic D.C. press corps community. Like this, the response you had from the Politico reporter who apologized to Twitter for retweeting that New York Post piece about Hunter Biden, saying, you know, I wasn't trying to advance the story. I was just trying to highlight the infirmities with the story, and I apologize for retweeting something that you had taken down, and because his account got suspended for retweeting it. So, you know, those sort of complimentary examples tell us that we're going down what path when it comes to a free press, frankly.
Well, we've been going down this dangerous path, and I interviewed an executive from a national news organization who said to me this fear of being deplatformed, so even those who want to tell the truth, who aren't aboard with these corporate and political narratives, they're bullied and they're actually coerced into self-censorship. He said that the newsman in me wants to tell the truth about certain stories, but what sort of Pyrrhic victory would that be if I'm then deplatformed and can't have any voice at all? So he said, I pull my punches. Now think about that. This is a major national news organization that's admitting they don't put certain things out for fear of these organized mob attacks and controversialization of him and his authors and the platform that happens when you go off the narrative they want you to be. And this is being effective in impacting what we get to see in the final product on news. So I think that there will be an outgrowth, I hope, of alternative platforms. I know there are people, smart people and technical people, trying to think of ways where independent information can be presented in various views and scientific studies in a way that you cannot be deplatformed and censored and taken down because you've simply expressed an opinion or given a view or put out information, true or not. Guess what? You have a right to put out information that may not be true. And the arbiters that are appointing themselves censors, oftentimes news organizations, have been famously wrong about so many things. For them to try to pretend they're the ones that are going to tell us what's true and what's not, particularly when we don't yet know and something's developing, is actually silly. And yet that accomplishes the goal of making sure we don't see certain information.
You know, it's so interesting because that sort of explanation reminds me of the I pull punches, I have sacred cows, because I have to protect my access to, you know, newsmakers and people who are influential.
Right.
So I'm not going to be a real journalist for some people because I need my access to them. And it's remarkable to me that journalists don't understand, number one, that they're being useful idiots. Number two is that as soon as they outlive their utility, then they'll be cast aside whether or not they've whether or not they protected those institutions or those sources for a period of time or not.
Well, if news organizations have the will to stand strong and weren't conflicted with these interests and influences, they have the power. We have the power. And I used to argue the same point I talked about in my last book, that, like you said, there will be beat reporters who say, I have to stay in good with the State Department or the White House or the FDA, or I won't get access to the next big interview or to the next big scoop. Well, guess what? They're not telling you anything that is a big scoop. They're not giving you news. They're giving you propaganda that they want put out. They're not giving you other stuff. So you're not going to be harmed if they cut you off. And a recognition of that would enable them to have the power to just report honestly and fairly. And if everybody did that, they'd have no control over the news by denying access to the next handout interview or piece of propaganda that they want people to have. But everybody plays the game, and so it turns out to be quite effective.
She is Cheryl Atkinson, investigative journalist, Emmy Award-winning host of Full Measure. Her new book, which was just released this week, yesterday, I think, Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. You want to pick that up. Cheryl, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Did I hear the Oak Ridge Boys called by Mike Scott?
Yeah.
My heart is on fire for Elvira.
There you go.
Bop, mow, mow, mow.
Excellent. Keep going.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Richard Sturban.
Yeah. Oh, nice poll.
There you go.
Very good, Mike Scott. Restaurants. So we mentioned this John Cass column yesterday, talking about the impact of on the restaurant industry, hospitality industry, generally speaking, with the lockdown and bus policies advanced by our overlords, Pritzker and Lightfoot. The death of a dream is how it was characterized by a Chicago restaurateur, a successful Chicago restaurateur, now made his way out to the suburbs, Jimmy Benakis, who has the Juicy O restaurant on Findlay Road in Downers Grove. You don't see the death of a dream. You know, what you don't see in terms of impact of policy. You don't see the restaurant owner with their heart cut out, losing their home they put up for collateral and all their savings. You don't see that, or the marriage is broken under the stress. You don't see the guilt that comes with failure or depth of feeling for the employees and their kids that you've watched grow up all their lives and call you Papuli, which is little grandfather in Greek. A good restaurant is a family, he went on to say, but most people who haven't spent years in a restaurant don't see that. And coming out of COVID-19, whenever we get off this merry-go-round of lockdown policies, one wonders how many dreams will have died, how many restaurants that we used to see we won't see. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid friend of John Cass, Jimmy Benakis. Jimmy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. So, I mean, you know, you have run big restaurants in the city. You're part of Let Us Entertain You group, as I understand it from John's column. And now you're out in the burbs doing your own thing. And so, I mean, you have some real breath with respect to the restaurant industry in Chicago Metro. So, you know, tell us from your perspective what's happening.
Well, I grew up during the Vietnam era. That's when I came of age. And I remember generals telling us at the time we had to burn down the village in order to save it. And I have to say, you know, I feel like a lot of our leaders are without, I don't, they've been thrust into this situation, but I think they're taking the same tack, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, you know, to put it in the perspective, a year ago, the economy was roaring. You know, we had low interest rates historically. Well, consumer confidence was at an all-time high, and most restaurateurs, the successful ones, were expanding cautiously, but they were expanding. And then we had COVID, which nobody expected, and it, especially people that extended themselves, are really in trouble right now, unfortunately.
And I mean, is there any help at all from the government? I know they have these grants, and but the small business owners I know have applied for those and they didn't get them. So then what do you do?
You,
I mean, I
Amy?
Know people that are not paying them. They're not paying their rent to the landlord because they can't, because there's no money to do that. And this restaurant tax in Chicago goes doubles by on January 4th.
Amy, we're going to have to dig ourselves out of this just like we always do. Restaurateurs, the successful ones, the good ones, are problem solvers, and they always come up with systems. I mean, if you look at all the successful guys like Dick Portillo, he was like the Henry Ford of street food, you know. And there's a lot of people like Ray Kroc. I mean, it was all about systems, solving problems, and I think we're going to get ourselves out of this. There's going to be some bodies, you know, laying on the road, but we'll dig ourselves out.
How many? I mean, what percentage of restaurants?
It's hard to say. I mean, here, tonight, for example, tonight, last year, and historically, it's the busiest bar night of the year.
More
and
so
all the
than
bars are closed.
Amy knows that.
So, well, no, it's more busy than New Year's Eve. The Wednesday before Thanksgiving, because everyone
Blackout
comes home
Friday.
From college.
Or Blackout Wednesday, right, yeah.
And St. Patrick's Day. The next 6 weeks in the restaurant business account for 33% of the sales for the entire year. So we're all going to be dark, and you can't just turn the switch on, turn it off, look at a chart, turn on the switch. We have to solve the problem. We can't just burn the village down.
But the numbers aren't there. I mean, if you look at the county by county, the number one cause of spread, again, is nursing homes and assisted living centers. Restaurants in DuPage are 1.6 or 1.4% when they had the contact tracing.
You know what, Amy? I'll leave that to you. You're the pundit. I just flip pancakes for a living. But, I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not blaming Pritzker. I think he's the last guy. Personally, I'm not, because I don't think he signed up for this. You know, I mean, this.
He's governor. He signed up for this. Are you kidding me? He can reverse this.
I don't. I think he thought it was going to be largely ceremonial or something.
That may be true, but what happens when I win? Now what do I do?
Listen, there was a time when I was sitting next to this real wealthy guy at a dinner, and I don't mean rich. I mean, he was really wealthy. And I said, what's it like? You know, I mean, and he said, well, it's being able to buy yourself out of any aggravation or mistake. That's the best thing about having this much money. And I'm sure that the governor is like that, but he's in a situation now where he can't get out of it. Unfortunately, right. He can't buy his way out.
But he can make the right decisions. I'm not settling for that.
Yeah, Jimmy, I got to tell you, I mean, I think we have a problem in this city and state, generally speaking, which is why it's the worst governed city in America and the worst governed state in American history. And that is we sort of say,
you didn't know.
Yeah, I know it's a tough thing, and we'll muddle through. But the last thing we want to do is hold people actually in charge accountable. I mean, it seems like that's the first thing we should do, and we haven't done a very good job of it, which is maybe why we continue to get people who run for governor and become governor who think it's a ceremonial post rather than an executive one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they keep promising us they're going to fix the problem. It never gets fixed. And I think if you had problem solvers in there, courageous people, they'd be able to do it. But again, I'm not blaming Pritzker. You know, he seems like
he's very jolly.
In the headlights.
Sometimes I feel sorry for him. So your restaurant there, are you keeping it open, or do you have tents or igloos out there at Juicy O's?
No. I mean, I've seen now that people are building buildings
right.
outside
structures.
Of the restaurant.
Yep.
I mean, what
the building a restaurant outside the restaurant.
Yeah.
Right.
I hope, it's not even a restaurant. It's a cold, drafty, damp restaurant.
Some of them are nice, and they bring in those, you know, those heaters that you see on the sidelines at NFL games. And it's no difference than if you're in that
heater,
building.
If you're next to the heater, it's too damn hot. And if you're on the other side of the room, it's too cold. So I don't know. It's not the solution completely. I think we should be able to open up at 50%. The restaurant industry, outside of the healthcare industry, we're the industry that is most concerned with health, welfare, food safety, alcohol awareness. I mean, you know, we know how to do things. We were keeping people safe. If during the summer, if it was a breeding ground for COVID, all our servers and busboys would be on ventilators, and they're not.
Nope.
Well, here's the other thing, too. I mean, the silliness of this all, I mean, this is almost like a Monty Python sketch. You can't be inside in the restaurant, but you can build a restaurant outside that essentially has the same functionality, except it's less effective and less enjoyable and less comfortable. So I'm sorry, what is the difference? What is the difference between me being inside in a heated restaurant and me being outside in a heated building outside the restaurant?
The difference is wonderfully piece of red snapper perfectly cooked inside or a cold, damp, and then broccoli outside.
All right. But it's a lot of restaurants. You know, one restaurant owner I know said, I can't spend $12,000 on six tables that I don't know are going to get filled because, you know, when the gale force winds and the sleet and snow comes, no one's going to want to sit outside. So how many restaurants have closed? Last count I heard was 5,000 in the state of Illinois. Do you know? And have you talked to any of them?
I don't know. Oh, my God. I talk to people every day. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you one thing. It's a fraternity. The independent restaurants are a fraternity that are so supportive of each other. I mean, to a person, I could tell you all these people that are friends or acquaintances of mine that your listeners would know. And to a man, to a person, they're all telling, you know, we tell each other, like, if you need anything, call me. What can I do to help? You know, I mean, such a supportive, great group of guys.
And talk to people about the ripple effect, too, when you're talking about, 25, 40, 50% of restaurants that are around Chicago Metro today not being around in 6 months or a year. What the ripple effect on suppliers and the rest of the ecosystem that supports restaurants?
It goes all the way down to the farmers, the guy who's making eggs. When you just come up and say shut down on Friday, what are you going to do with the 35 pounds of red snapper in your walk-in box? You know, if you're a fish restaurant. And I mean, the ripple effect is amazing. And the effect on people, employees, people who depend on restaurants to eat. I know so many people that can't open a can of soup at home.
Dan,
you're talking to one of them. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
He doesn't know where the kitchen is.
Yeah, without you, Jimmy, I'm lost. Is basically going to starve to death.
Let's talk about that. So they did, because then you don't know what to order because you don't know what's coming around the bend next week or in 2 weeks.
I mean, that's the key point right there. You don't know what's happening tomorrow, and we're an industry that plans on the future. We look at the past and we plan on what we're going to do in the future, and it's agonizing, you know, because I knew when this whole thing became political early in the summer that we were going to be the football, this industry.
Well, how did it become political? What was your aha moment where you realized, this is different?
When one side started blaming the other side for how well they were handling the situation. And 25 years ago as a country, we would all pull together on something like this, not all politics, but something like this, and fought it together. This became, you know, the main topic of the political season. And I knew people like us were going to be in trouble.
You and our kids.
Jimmy, I've been critical of the bigger players, the bigger restaurateurs and restaurant groups in Chicago, like your former employer, former partner, Let Us Entertain You, and the Melman family, or Lombardo and Gibson's, because they have political clout, and they can do for the restaurant industry what a lot of the small, one-off, independent restaurants can't do. And, you know, you mentioned the word courage earlier in the program with respect to, earlier in the interview, with respect to politicians. Well, that applies across the board, and I don't think that those individuals who have outsized influence compared to the independents have exercised their influence, have shown the courage that they should show in these times. Is that unfair to them?
For a lot of the guys that I know, it's a little bit unfair because they're not politicians and they don't dwell in that world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think they might, but they don't. They're wrapped up in what they do. A guy like Rich Homan, for example, he's in love with what he does. He's so good at it.
Right.
And when you ask him to step out and do something else, I remember when I was working with him and he'd have to make a speech for an organization or something, and he just couldn't take doing that. You know, I'd help him once in a while, I'd help him write the speech. And he was always much more comfortable just talking about restaurants and dealing with that. And he's just not that political, I know, but
yeah, I hear you. It's just one of those things. I mean, you've seen some letters that have been written to the mayor's office when she turned over the streets to the mob, essentially, from jewelers and from another concern that has a bunch of real estate in the city, people that are not political either, that don't want to weigh into this stuff, but have felt compelled to. And you talk about what our country used to be, and, you know, sometimes the circumstances demand that you do something you're otherwise disinclined to do. And I just think that to people that have that sort of influence that could really force some additional consideration than is otherwise being given from politicians, you know, have an outsized duty to intervene.
Yeah, you might be right, but I, you know, I think this whole thing is so overwhelming and the rules keep changing and it throws everybody for a loop.
Yeah, that's fair. I talked to John Taffer, who's a colorful guy, as I'm sure you know, a couple of weeks ago, and he said he was actually fairly sanguine about the restaurant and hospitality industry, talking about, you know, if we get past this and vaccines distributed and so forth, he thinks there could be a real restaurant renaissance by the perhaps end of the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter next year. Now, that won't mean that there's not going to be a lot of waste, you know, left in the wake, a lot of people who've lost their restaurants and businesses, and that's a terrible thing. But there can be this, there's opportunities and there can be this renaissance. But he did say about Chicago right after the second lockdown was reinstituted. He said, you know, that is a tragic mistake. That is a terrible mistake that Chicago is making, because that is going to put Chicago, which of course is a great restaurant city, as everybody knows, really behind the learning curve and behind the recovery curve as compared to the rest of the nation.
You're right. And Chicago is an independent town for restaurants. I mean, even if you go to New York and you walk down the street, you'll see Pizza Huts and Olive Gardens and mixed in with everything else. Here, that doesn't exist. You know, it's just independent restaurants in all the neighborhoods in River North. So that's going to have a big bearing on it.
He is Jimmy Benakis. He's the owner of Juicy O Restaurant in Downers Grove. Support Juicy O when it's open, as long as it can be open.
Is it a carryout, or what do you have?
And other restaurants, too. By the way, we're continuing with Tom Sedeka and a bunch of people, our tour of restaurants that are staying open in defiance of the governor's orders around the region. And I encourage other people to, just like we're setting up pods for to teach your kids,
yeah,
set up a restaurant or lunch groups to go around to these restaurants and support these restaurants that are open as long as you can. It would be my suggestion, one thing that anybody can do. Jimmy Benakis, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your perspective.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, on the occasion of the Dow breaking the 30,000 barrier for the first time, President Trump held a brief press briefing, and I do mean brief.
Well, thank you very much, and I just want to congratulate everybody. The stock market, Dow Jones Industrial Average, just hit 30,000, which is the highest in history. We've never broken 30,000, and that's just despite everything that's taken place with the pandemic. I'm very thrilled with what's happened on the vaccine front. That's been absolutely incredible. It's nothing like that has ever happened medically, and I think people are acknowledging that, and it's having a big effect. But the stock market's just broken 30,000, never been broken, that number. That's a sacred number, 30,000. Nobody thought they'd ever see it. That's the ninth time since the beginning of 2020, and it's the 48th time that we've broken records in during the Trump administration. And I just want to congratulate all the people within the administration that work so hard. And most importantly, I want to congratulate the people of our country, because there are no people like you. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Mr. President, where you concede?
And on a hot mic, one of the reporters said that was weird as shh.
Poo-poo.
It was a little strange. I mean, just first of all, we've talked about this before. This president, any president, claiming credit or taking blame for where the Dow or the NASDAQ is on any given day is a bit silly. The other thing, like, we all did this together. Yeah, I mean, it's a real testament to quantitative easing, isn't it? Not that I'm not complaining, because, you know, my investment funds benefit like anybody else in the market. But, I don't know. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Wall Street Journal columnist and Trumponomics author Steve Moore. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. What about Trump's decision to come out and make sure everybody knew that the reason the Dow's at 30,000 is because of him.
Well, look, I disagree with you on this. I mean, it's one thing to look at, to talk about 1 or 2 days or a week or a month's increase in the Dow, but we've seen these trends now for, 4 years. This has been an incredibly bullish market.
Yeah.
It's been a time, I think when he came to office, we were at about 24,000. Now we're at, 30,000. That's an incredible long bull market expansion. And by the way, don't forget, it was exactly 4 years ago, Dan and Amy, that people like Paul Krugman said that if Donald Trump is elected president, we're going to have a Great Depression and the stock market is going to crash. So, I think Krugman thought that the Dow was going to be at 15,000, not 30,000 after 4 years of Trump. And one last thing, I don't think there's any question in my mind that if the election were today, Donald Trump would win easily. I mean, we've had two incredible accomplishments. One is the continued boom of the economy, and the second is this vaccine. Not one vaccine, but it now looks like there are three that are going to be available by the early next year. And incidentally, that's by far the fastest we've ever had a vaccine developed. Usually it takes 5 or 6 years. Those are two stupendous accomplishments.
Yeah, but Biden's team is saying, wait a minute now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 30,000 because he announced his national security team.
Yeah, and his Treasury Secretary. Look, I actually think that Janet Yellen is probably a pretty solid choice for Biden. By the way, I would make the case, Amy, that this was a big sigh of relief that it's not Elizabeth Warren who's going to be the Treasury Secretary.
Janet Yellen, before she was an economist, was she Captain Kangaroo on that TV show? Wasn't she?
No. That's a very politically incorrect.
Well, they have the same blazer and hairstyle.
Just
you guys are mean.
Yeah. You think?
Mean
so,
girls.
But look, I think what's going on right now, the big question for the stock market, of course, is what happens in those Georgia Senate races. You all know Republicans have to win one out of the two. If they don't, then you get not only Biden, but you get also Pelosi running the House, and you get Chuckie Schumer running the Senate. So you get a murderer's row with no check and balance on the tax increases, the Green New Deal, the Medicare for All, the making, Washington, D.C., the 51st state, the court backing, the filibuster end. I think that one of the reasons the market has been, pretty buoyant is that even though Biden is president and going to be president likely, and even though his policies are, in my opinion, very bad on the economy, I think investors believe that a lot of those policies will never be enacted.
Well, I mean, since I guess we're going to go along with this idea, we're all Keynesians now. We believe things that are untrue, like government spending is stimulative. We believe in the Phillips curve, like Janet Yellen still does. If we're going to do that, and we're going to believe that quantitative easing had nothing to do with the rebound in the stock market, $7 trillion in additional debt, then why not throw another trillion on the pyre in the form of COVID-19 relief, send another $1,200 checks out, and more expand unemployment benefits and the whole thing?
So, look, you and I and most rational people understand what the pinheads in Washington don't understand, which is that government spending is a negative for the economy. It's not a positive. It's a negative for the economy because the government, takes a dollar from productive people and gives the dollar to unproductive people. That's not a way to get more productivity. And we also know that printing money is not the solution to, a crisis. You can't just print. If printing money were the solution to a crisis, Mexico would be the richest country in the world. So that stuff doesn't work. And you're right, Dan, that there is this kind of superstition, I guess I'd use the word, that somehow we can get out of our troubles by printing money and by spending. Now, that being said, I think one of the most heroic things Donald Trump has done in the last 3 or 4 months has been to resist this call for another, $2-3 trillion spending bill. I mean, Trump basically, even to his own political peril, perhaps, said, no, Nancy Pelosi, I'm not going to give you $2.5-3 trillion so you can give the money to Illinois and California and New York and Connecticut and Rhode Island. We're not doing that. And we are not going to give another $600 a week benefits in unemployment to people. We have a new report coming out with from Casey Mulligan at University of Chicago this week that shows we would have 4 million fewer working Americans if Trump had agreed to that, because if you paid people not to work, guess what? They won't work. So I think Trump deserves a lot of credit for that. And what he has proven, Dan, is that we don't need another stimulus. The economy is doing fine without it.
What if you could get Democrats to agree on lawsuit indemnification?
Did you ask, will they agree to it?
No. What if you could get congressional Democrats to agree on indemnifying businesses from lawsuits? Would you horse trade money for that?
Several more million people working. I mean, that would be the greatest stimulus of all, right?
No. But would you horse trade what they want for that?
Well, it depends on what the deal is. But do we need to send checks out, $1,200 checks out to people? No. Do we need increased unemployment insurance? No. Do we want a blue state bailout? No. Do we want to give, $150 billion to the schools that aren't open? No. I mean, tell me what you like about that package, Dan.
I don't like anything about that package. I'm just asking you what you think would be a deal to be made if you could indemnify businesses to encourage them to open and be unafraid of opening.
So my view on this has been very consistent from the start. The only stimulus that really matters is allowing businesses to open up and allowing workers to go back on the job. There's no amount of checks the government can write to people that can offset the negative impact of putting businesses into bankruptcy. And, you know, I have two good friends here in my local area, in the D.C. area, who own restaurants. And, you know, Dan and Amy, they put their whole life savings into those restaurants. I mean, they put everything they had into it. They spent 5 to 10 years building up the restaurants. It's not an easy business. I know the politicians sound like geniuses about business. They don't know anything about business. And both of them are very teetering on the verge of bankruptcy because guess what? Washington, D.C. is shut down again. Maryland is shutting down again. And you can't do this to your businesses. It's the men and women who put everything they got into it. And now they're going to get smacked right on the nose again. And it's happening in Chicago as well, right? Your restaurants are shutting down.
During the busiest time of the year.
Exactly. Sure. You know what they did here? What? I don't know if they did it in Chicago. They're saying tonight, by the way, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving is one of the biggest restaurant nights of the year.
It's a party night, yeah.
In a lot of states now, they're saying that no restaurants on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
Right, and they're cutting off alcohol sales in Pennsylvania tonight, too.
But they're not cutting off heroin possession in Oregon.
So no, and they're not shutting down marijuana stores.
And also, if you're having a parade celebrating Joe Biden's presidency, you can do that, but you can't go into a restaurant.
That's right. Let me ask you this, Steve. You mentioned at the outset about the Georgia Senate runoffs, and we know it would be a catastrophe where both of those races go down and you lose control of the Senate. We know what's going to happen then. We're going to become France.
Yep.
If that doesn't happen and Republicans do control
France without the food, right?
Yeah, exactly. If that doesn't happen, Republicans retain control of the Senate, what is the thing you most worry about Biden being able to get through with some Republican support?
I don't think there's almost any likelihood of a tax in. You mean if he has a Republican Senate?
Right.
Oh, I don't think that there would be a tax increase. I just don't think Republicans would go along with that. But I do think Republicans are likely to go along with big spending initiatives because Republicans are big spenders now too, Dan. I hate to disillusion you.
Yeah.
they like spending money as much as Democrats do. So I worry about a budget blowout under a Biden presidency. And the other thing I'm really worried about is this weird obsession the left has with climate change. I mean, here we are in the middle of a pandemic. We still have, 10 million Americans we've got to get jobs for. We've got, rioting in the streets of a lot of our cities.
Kids back in school.
They're failing. And all they want to talk about is climate change. I mean, people are...
Well, that's because they announced the czar yesterday. He's going to make it all better. But Stephen Moore, I just wanted to ask you this. I know that you have an inside to President Trump. How is he doing? Is he accepting this? Where does he stand right now?
Well, I think a lot of us are still, including, the Trump folks like myself, and we're still in a little bit of denial. This is what, the second stage of grief or the first stage?
They
haven't thrown in the towel. I am extraordinarily annoyed by the media saying, how dare Donald Trump, question the results of the voters. Look, it's very likely that Biden has won this election, but it's not certain. There's still votes to be counted. There's still a lot of evidence that, I don't want to use the word evidence, suspicion of widespread fraud in a lot of these states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Georgia. But, I was thinking about 4 years ago. I mean, the left had riots in the streets when Trump was elected. The left at this point 4 years ago, go back, folks, and look at the record. The left was basically trying to do this ploy where electors would vote against the person, against Donald Trump, even though he had won the state. I mean, that's a coup. That's a coup attempt. And then, of course, they had spent 2 years trying to, on a phony, charge of Russia collusion, tried to impeach the man. So this idea that somehow, Republicans and Trump are trying to overturn an election, I mean, Democrats, look in the damn mirror.
He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, and author of Trumponomics. Steve, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I'm going to have 11 people over. Please don't tell my governor.
we're getting on the phone to KK Northam right after you get off.
Governors, they're going around with binoculars, looking in people's windows to make sure there are not too many people around the Thanksgiving table.
Sickening. All right. Have a good one. And remember, gobble, 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 gobble. And Stephen Moore joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
That Dan and Amy, dude that rescued his little spaniel from an alligator down in Florida.
Yeah, it's a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel named Gunner.
Yeah, it's so Richard cute. Wilbanks and Gunner. The Wilbanks family comes to Estero, Florida, which is not far from me down in Florida. Maybe I'll go visit.
Oh, yeah.
They come to Estero, Florida from Central Texas Hill Country. Of course they do. Yeah. And, of course, the greatest thing about that is the cigar never left his mouth as he rescued his pup. He let the little gator go, too.
Yeah, it was a six-foot gator that lunged out of nowhere, he said, grabbed his little puppy, brought him in the water. He was so calm and cool, like a surgeon, a heart surgeon. Did you see that?
It was great. Now Gunner has a new leash on life.
And Frank Robb better watch it. His job is somebody's behind his back wanting his job.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Damie. I know we're 3 weeks away from finality with respect to the presidential election, and there is much litigation yet to be adjudicated. But just a thought experiment.
Okay.
And again, assume that it's a good idea for Trump to give a concession speech if ultimately he exhausts his legal options and finds himself on the wrong side of 270-plus electoral votes. What should Trump say in his concession speech if, again, at some point in the next 3 weeks, he is prompted to give one? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And before we take your calls on that, get your perspectives, let's update what his legal team is saying. And those formerly of his legal team are saying, as of yesterday, Jenna Ellis was on with Charles Payne on Fox Business, and she talked about not only the litigation, but this new front that's open. Three states whose state legislatures are opening oversight investigations into the administration of the elections in their states. They're holding hearings.
Well, importantly, we have a pending appeal before the Supreme Court. We also have one in the Third Circuit that just yesterday agreed to hear an expedited appeal. And really importantly, we now have three state legislatures in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona that have agreed to hold hearings because it's in everyone's best interest and all Americans to make sure that the truth about the voter fraud and the proof that we have comes out. And so they are very concerned. And let's remember that it's the state legislatures that are constitutionally vested with the selection process of the electoral Electoral College delegates. That's the safeguard that we have in our system to make sure that elections that are corrupted do not ultimately render a wrong selection for the president that is outside of what the people actually voted for. So we now have three state legislatures that are very concerned about the corruption of this election and are willing to get to the bottom of it. So this is far from over, and President Trump will continue to fight.
Far from over. And remember, one of the statistical anomalies with Biden's apparent victory, the only metropolitan areas where he outperformed Hillary Clinton from 4 years ago, Phoenix, Detroit, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Atlanta. Isn't that convenient, as a church lady would perhaps say, if you were still around?
Phoenix, Detroit, Philadelphia, Atlanta.
And Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Those turned out to be important swing states.
Juggernauts.
You'll,
yeah.
You'll note. Yeah. Sidney Powell was on, formerly of the Trump campaign legal team, or de facto a part of the legal team, and now doing her own thing, as we understand. She was on Lou Dobbs yesterday, and she said there is a major complaint that she will be filing today in the state of Georgia.
Okay.
Well, I think no later than tomorrow. It's just going to be, it's a massive document, and it's going to have a lot of exhibits.
And who will be the defendant or defendants?
The defendants are going to be folks in Georgia who are responsible for supposedly making sure the elections in Georgia are done properly. And there are just countless incidents of voter fraud and election fraud writ large in Georgia.
Who are the defendants? Why? Isn't that like step one?
Well, they'll be named in the complaint that's filed today if what she said is true, and it'll be, I assume, the governor, the secretary of state, and other related officials that have authority with respect to the administration of the elections. I don't think that's so much in controversy. What's more in controversy is exactly what evidence will be included in the complaint that she files. We'll see. She did say that she is like Rudy Giuliani. She's aware of the timelines that are on. She's aware they're on a December 8th, December 14th clock, and she's going to meet those timelines.
Well, obviously, it couldn't be more urgent, but yes, the time deadlines should be able to be met, and the evidence is so overwhelming, it's almost as though they were so blatant about it, they expected us to catch it, and, you know, maybe it's a diversion from something else that's going on. I don't know, but it's also clear that there was foreign intrusion into our voting systems, and that's going to be the real where the rubber meets the road.
That's going to be where the rubber meets the road and saves the Trump presidency.
Do you think that we're going to see the Trump presidency saved?
Yes, I definitely do. There's no issue in my mind but that he was elected in an absolute landslide nationwide.
Hmm.
Okay, well,
we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those, you know, she responds to questions about one of her previous big claims with even bigger claims. She's talking foreign intrusion, so she's talking, I assume, about some of the foreign interests that allegedly have stakes in involvement with these vendors like Smartmatic, the software vendor that was founded you know, with some Venezuelan influence at minimum, as well as Dominion voting systems. Big claims, foreign intrusion. And she said filing a big suit, so many exhibits, a lot of evidence, overwhelming, so obvious that it's almost like they were trying to get caught. That's what she said.
Well, she better. I mean, she's going to file something. She should file it today because we're looking at a 4-day weekend.
Well, she said she's going to file it today, so we'll see what she does, and we'll report on it as soon as it's filed. But assuming, again, thought experiment, something to kick around with your 5 or fewer, 9 or fewer, depending on your state, co-diners at your Thanksgiving Day dinner tomorrow. If Trump exhausts all his legal options, he's on the wrong side of 270 electoral votes, should he concede? And I'm sort of saying he should offer a concession speech. And it's not so much, you know, there's ways to do concession speeches. You don't have to genuflect. You don't have to bend the knee before, you know, the authority of King's Landing. I mean, you just have to offer some parting remarks. I think it's incumbent upon Trump to offer parting remarks. Maybe that's a better way to say it than concession speech. I wouldn't spend a lot of time conceding, but I think after his consequential presidency, some parting remarks are appropriate. What should they include? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Patrick in Glenview, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes,
I would not concede to these people. The way they talked to him before he even got in office, talking to him like that was like talking to all of us that support him. Having Obama spying on him while he's just getting in office, all the crooked crap. No, I would bring that back up to the people, to his fans. He's got 78 million of us. We don't want to hear up there kissing ass. We know he won't. He won't. He's got to bring it out to the public. He's going to get the network TV. And then he can also promote his new TV network, Trump TV News.
All right. Thanks, Patrick. I mean, yeah, I'm not suggesting ass kissing, and I don't think he would or should. But I'm suggesting parting remarks. What should they contain? And I agree that it should be in large measure directed towards the 74-odd million people who voted for him. And maybe some parting remarks as well. But don't forget, there are things that are important to Trump and to his legacy that are still at stake, even if he has declared the loser of this race. The Georgia Senate races.
Right.
And, you know, he is going to need to be part of motivating Trump voters to get out and support Perdue and Loeffler in Georgia. How he handles potentially his departure from the scene will be important for Georgia, for Republican control of the Senate, for the preservation of some of the things, at least, that he accomplished as president.
And besides giving a possible concession speech, can you see him at the inauguration? Sitting there with the other presidents and accepting this? I don't know.
You know,
or is everybody going to be in their little igloo or in a car? Because this inauguration is going to be different.
Yes. You know. Joe Biden will have everybody in cars on the mall. Right.
Exactly.
Marge in Norridge.
Hi. You just mentioned departure from the scene. I'm a Trump supporter. I do not want him to concede. I don't believe he is going to depart from the scene, and as a supporter, I will continue to follow him and support him, whatever he chooses to do in the next 4 years. And I hope he continues to have rallies. I don't even know what they would be for, but we need his presence. We need to let the Democratic Party know we are not accepting this, and we do not intend to move forward in the fashion that they prefer us to move forward. That's all. No concessions.
All right.
Well, then don't sound like Hillary Clinton supporters. If we're not going to accept this election. We're not, I want him to go rally. I mean, he's not going to go away. He's got millions of followers on Twitter, and he's still going to tweet CNN, who thinks that he's just going to disappear. He's not going to disappear.
Well, I don't mean permanent departure from the scene. I mean departure from the scene and mean no longer being president of the United States. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have other roles to play and influence to wield. Of course he does.
And during the midterm elections, he'll be back. I mean,
I think it's a mistake to say that no parting remarks, if it comes to that, are appropriate. I think they're appropriate. I think they could be very helpful. And I've actually written something, but I'll let you guys weigh in first.
Oh, okay.
John in East Chicago.
Hello. Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
I don't think President Trump should concede because he won, in actuality. He won the election.
Okay. Thanks for the call, John. Tony in Downers Grove.
Okay. On a serious note, if I'm Trump, I would highlight the policies that were put in place before he took office, after he took office, the differences, and really implore the people to get out and vote in the Georgia election like you were talking about, and also highlight who's being put in those cabinet positions and to really focus on what actually is being done and what's going to be done and keep the foot on the pedal and don't be negative.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Tony. Tony's starting to get warm in terms of where I'm at on this. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, well, you know what he should do is during his concession, he should cite everything he has done that increased the economy. because, you know, you guys have been talking about the extreme lockdowns that have been happening because of the Chinese flu. The reason the Democrats are doing that now is because the economy is bouncing back. And if they don't destroy the economy before Trump gets out of office, it would be very obvious that it is Biden's policies that destroy the recovery. So these extreme lockdowns are an attempt to destroy the economy before he gets in there. Then they can spend the next 4 years blaming Trump for the bad economy that Biden's going to create. And so Trump should take his time during the concession speech and mention everything that he has done with the energy independence, low gas prices, even in the middle of the Chinese flu, the unemployment rate has been cut in half from the Chinese flu. And then he should do that so that there is on record what the economy was before Joe Biden took over. And then maybe whoever the Republican is, if we can have a fair and free election next time, they can point to the fact that, you know, Trump had the economy going and Biden and Harris destroyed the economy. Now that may
Thanks
be something he could do.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Carol in Moments.
Hi, good morning, and happy Thanksgiving to you and Amy. And
happy Thanksgiving.
I think President Trump needs to continue his USA rallies and make sure that people put America first, because God knows the Democrats will not.
All right, thanks for the call, Carol. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, thank you, Dan, for taking a call. Listen, I think it's so imperative now because of the deep state and the way that the way that the corruption that exists, it's got to be totally exposed. He needs to get out there and say, listen, here's what's been going on for 4 years. You've seen it, what they've done to me and everything, how these actors all have gotten together and everything like that. Now with the election, they took and did the same thing. They took and stole this election like that. If we don't get this right, if we don't get this exposed and corrected, this country's gut shot. The time for like talking nice and all that, it's over with. We're getting too far where there's too many corrupt actors and too many of our Justice Department and CIA and, you know, FBI people that are involved in it. They're part of this. They're part of this that's going to destroy this country, and there won't be no coming back from what they're doing to it. He's got to make that clear.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Oh, yes. Good morning, Dan and Amy. I have a lot of thoughts on this, but today I just want to wish you, your family, and your Cruz family happy and healthy Thanksgiving and happy holidays. And I will continue to listen to you every day. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Rich. Thanks. We appreciate it. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family and your friends. And I'll offer what I think. Again, this is a hypothetical. It's a thought exercise. Just stick with me on this. You know, I know it could turn out differently. I understand we have 3 weeks. I concede all of those things. There's my concession speech. This is just a thought experiment. How you want Trump to leave office if that's what comes to pass, if that's what he is compelled to do, if. And I'll give my offering, and probably in our open mic Friday, which is Wednesday because of the holiday,
yes,
at 8:35.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday.
Wednesday!
Calling now. Open mic
Wednesday.
Dan and Amy, good morning. And, of course, Open Mic Friday on this Wednesday because of the holiday, taking your calls with compliments, comments, concerns,
what's your
critiques,
for?
Crackpot conspiracy theories, 312-642-5600, turkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turkey.pro text line. I want to get to this discussion we've been having about what Trump should say, departing remarks, if after December 14th he does not have 270 electoral votes and Joe Biden does. And I've got my own prepared remarks on the topic. But
oh, okay.
First we have to go on a bit of a tangent so that Amy can address something with respect to triple threat that she wants to address.
Well, actually, you know what? If I had my choice between triple threat and this fake nurse story, I'm going to go with a fake nurse story because
I would go with triple threat.
You would?
Yeah, I think so.
What the CNN did, this woman is a liar and everybody bought it. She said that people on their deathbeds are saying, oh, I thought it was a hoax, and then expiring. She's an ER nurse, not an ICU nurse. And when you have a ventilator in, you're not talking, okay? And everybody bought it. Pritzker, Dr. Fauci.
It's astounding how what you said is true, that people who are in IC beds, people who are in the hospital, still believe it's a hoax.
I'm just saying, I watch CNN, and I've heard you guys all say for 4 years they're fake news. They are officially fake news. I'm not watching them ever again because they didn't fact check this nurse. They didn't, and now they're not even apologizing for it. And this nurse still has her job in South Dakota. She should be fired because all they're trying to do is scare people.
Okay.
I'm better now. Thank
all
you.
All right. I'm glad you were able to have that cathartic experience with your friends, surrounded by your friends. So I think that's the best way to
all
do
my
it.
Friends in this room. Thank you.
Did you have something with Lightfoot about scotch and a cigar?
Yeah, because that's how this lady parties, if you know what I mean.
Last year, you celebrated your first budget victory with a scotch and a cigar. How do you plan to celebrate this year?
Exactly the same way.
And a
steak.
Was that, first of all, was that question
from Fran Spielman?
A robot? Number
person.
One. Yeah. Number two. And then did you go take a dump in the woods, too, because you're such a man? Triple threat? Hey, little guy, don't let the Joe Pesci fashion sense confuse you. You're not a dude. All right, you're trying too hard.
And here's the thing. Don't gas up in Chicago because of 3-cent tax. Don't speed because if you go over 6 miles per hour, they're going to up the ante for your fine. And then don't buy a house here because your property taxes are going to go up. Not a lot, but you know, they're still going up $50 to $60 a year.
All right. And transitioning from the surreal to hopefully the sublime, the question, Trump's departing remarks, hypothetical thought experiment. If 3 weeks from now, the legal avenues have been exhausted, he doesn't have the 270 electoral votes, he's out of options, and he must depart the scene. What would you have him say?
312.
Assuming that saying something is appropriate, which I think it is.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Or you can text 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Lisa in Edison Park.
Hi, Dan, am I on?
Yep, you're on.
Yes. Okay, so if he does have to leave office, he should give a speech. And I agree with the points the others have made, highlight his accomplishments, highlight the policy differences, emphasize the importance of Georgia and the support for that. But in addition, pay attention. His message to everybody, especially those who didn't vote for him, pay attention. Vary your news sources. Notice if subjective terms are automatically and consistently being thrown in when the mainstream media, quote unquote, reports something. Try different search engines, et cetera. Open up your mind a little bit. See what's happening out there.
All right. That's good. Lisa, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Sam in Oak Brook.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Happy Thanksgiving to you guys.
Same to you.
I just want to talk about how the press has switched from reporting, like they reported yesterday, 9,000 probable cases. They're not reporting positive cases. So when you go to these mass lines for testing, which people are now doing every week, the only way you're supposed to go get a test is if you've been around a COVID-19 person or you have symptoms. Well, people fib because they just want to know, especially at Thanksgiving time. They want to get these tests to see if they're safe to go around their family. So people are fibbing that they've been around COVID-19 or they have symptoms. So when you get in these mass lines for the free test, you fib. They mark it down as a probable case, not a positive case.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to know what the numbers come back at of positive versus the probable later on down the road. It's a sham. It's a total sham. We don't use probable in the world of science. We use positive or negative. You don't have tests, pregnant tests. Well, you're probably pregnant.
Right, exactly. No, that's what positive. She said about Elon Musk. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Sam.
Well, we've asked, and she just says, oh, it's just a percentage, you know, of the 12,000 today, probably 5,000. I'll ask again today, but it's, they changed the rules 2 weeks before the election. Think about that. The CDC did that. Mm-hmm.
Dawn in Crystal Lake.
Hi there. Not only should President Trump not concede, but it's time to start a revolution. And what should happen as a quote-unquote parting shot is all the military, all the National Guard, all the police, veterans, anybody with a drop of Second Amendment blood in their veins should all come out and start driving out the riffraff in this country that are selling us out to foreign nations and destroying our core people.
All right, Don, thanks for the call. Tony and Steger.
Hey, guys, happy Thanksgiving.
Yes,
indeed. And I've changed my plans. Mm-hmm. I'm going to cook spaghetti and homemade meatballs for Thanksgiving instead of turkey, and I'm going to have it at my kids' house so they can do the dishes afterwards.
There you go.
All right, Tony. Thanks for sharing that.
I love
that.
Your laugh.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Oh. And maybe they'll give some other folks the similar idea. Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? Trump's confession speech should be he's getting up there and details all of the things that he did in his administration without any exaggeration, just quoting straight government figures, not only with the economy, but with foreign relations and everything else. And then at the end of the speech, he should say, and I'm now announcing my candidacy for 2024. That's it.
That's all right. Will, thanks for the call. Will, appreciate it. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning and happy Thanksgiving.
Same.
Hey, this is kind of a COVID question, and you know, it's the social distancing. It's a situation you might find yourself in. I just got to know how to react to it.
Uh-huh.
I'm walking down the sidewalk one direction, and our beloved governor's coming down the sidewalk in the other direction. As we pass, our arms touch, so we're physically touching, yet I'm more than 6 feet away from his face. Is that social distancing yet, or does the 12-foot rule kick in?
It's a great question, Rick. It's a great problem. Thanks for the call, except unfortunately I know that it's apocryphal and it could never happen because, as you know, J.B. Pritzker cannot walk down a sidewalk because he would break his legs if he attempted to.
Well,
his legs cannot support that kind of weight, particularly in motion.
That's how he broke his, fractured his femur the first time walking
right.
around at the state fair, and then standing was part of that, too.
He is currently a physical impossibility, so that's just not going to work.
Get his castle in order.
Deborah in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same.
If I was the president, I would list all my accomplishments, and I also would tell people to continue to keep America great, and I'll be back.
All right, like the Terminator. Got it. Thanks, Deborah. Tom Sedeka in Barrington.
Good morning, my favorite radio team. How are you?
Good.
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I tell you, our journalists in Chicago are so pathetic. Why don't they ask the mayor a more serious question, like boxers or briefs?
Because
nobody wants to think about
so
that, Tom.
Yeah. As far as Trump goes, Trump should have Kayleigh McEnany play stuff out of Hunter's laptop in the press room, and then also hand out all the emails to everybody. Leave a nice party shot. You guys have a happy Thanksgiving to you, the Salem team, and all the listeners. Be well.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Richard in Blue Island.
Yeah, hey, Dan and Amy. I got an idea how we find out how masks work, you know, and I think the way we do it is back in 1986, they had Hands Across America to fight hunger.
Yeah.
So we fight, you know, we'll have masks across America, and everybody holds hands and, you know, see who gets COVID. You know, everybody stand in the middle of the street. You know, wear masks and see who comes out with, you know, comes up with COVID.
All right. Thanks for the call, Richard.
The whole thing, if you have a mask, you can be closer than 6 feet. You know what I'm saying? Like, isn't that the purpose for the mask?
Oh, no. The mask is like a force field.
Oh, that's right. It's because
you're
superpowers.
That's what I understand. It's a panacea.
Everybody,
it's more important.
Yeah.
What did Redfield say? CDC's Redfield.
More
important than a vaccine.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Really? Tony on the South Side.
Fired, too.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy, my Lammy Land. I've been on hiatus. I've been dark for a few months. I've been training with the Oath Keepers, but that's beside the point. So listen,
okay.
I'll mention what Trump's concession speech should be last. So, but firstly, Cass's friend, Jerry Blankenship, whatever his name was.
Jimmy Benakis, yeah.
Jimmy right, Benakis, yeah, whatever his name was. Listen, see, what's going to kill his business is not the fact that COVID, because this guy's got disposable income. He's got a business built up for years and years and years. It's the small people that are getting hurt. Him saying he's not blaming Pritzker, I was appalled. I was like, you got to be kidding me. How does this guy not give a little bit of, a little bit of blame towards Pritzker? That was ridiculous. So, you know, I'm not going to support that guy's restaurant. I got friends of mine who got bars and restaurants in my area. They're not going to be able to make it. And, you know, they don't have the platform this guy does, and shame on him. And as far as Trump's concession speech, what I would suggest is that, you know, that one line in Wall Street at the end, you know, towards the middle when they were going to shut down, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street, and he got up there and he was, you know, saying he's not leaving. That's what Trump should just basically do. That's all right. And you guys have a great Thanksgiving and stay well.
All right. You too. Thanks, Tony. And remember, Tony is the man who coined Tangerine Jesus to describe Trump. So he has standing on the issue. Steve in Orland Park.
Regarding Donald Trump, what one man did all on his own with no help from anybody else for this country is simply amazing.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. I know a lot of people feel that way. They did have some help, but Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, real quick, on a more sour side, it is hard for Trump supporters to be told to donate money and get behind this Georgia election after we got the election stolen from us. But that being said, mm-hmm. Trump should get up there and say to Amy Jacobson, my theme for the next 4 years is winning, not I'm winning, because the name of the Santana song is just winning, not I'm winning.
Right.
And I just put a tarp on a church in Blue Island that I'm working on. It's a whole house tarp. When we're done with it, I'm willing to donate it to Pritzker for his underwear as soon as the election
All right,
is over.
Thanks for the
I
call,
thought it
Tom.
Was called... Oh, it says I'm winning, but it's called winning. Got it.
Yeah. Got that clarification now. Mm-hmm. Jeremy and Gurney.
Good morning to you both, and happy Thanksgiving.
Same.
I'm curious as to what the policy and standard is going to be once they start distributing the vaccine. Are there still going to be mask requirements, social distancing requirements for those who receive the vaccine, or how are they going to move forward with that?
It's a great question. That's a great question, Jeremy. I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody does. You know, once you have a certain percentage of the population vaccinated, what do you do? Do you keep these protocols in place in perpetuity? I don't know the answer, and I assume it will vary state from state, just as lockdown and bus policies have varied state from state. But those are the questions we should start asking. It's excellent. Cindy and Joliet.
Hey there. Good morning, Dan. Hi, Amy. Happy Thanksgiving. So this is, it's open mic, so here we go. Trump should announce that he's buying the state that offers him his biggest supporters, and then people can file their applications live there, and anybody that doesn't like it has.
Oh,
did
we lose
Cindy?
Did we lose her? Oh, sorry.
Oh, I wanted to hear the end.
Yeah, that was like my idea back in the day when plots of land were going for $5,000 in Detroit after it had filed for bankruptcy.
Oh yeah.
Like all the conservatives rush up and settle Detroit and make it like a Hong Kong in the middle of Michigan.
Oh yeah.
Make it like a free market zone. Well, that's interesting. A state of Trump. It's not just, it's actually a physical location. It's not just a state of mind. Sorry for cutting you off there, Cindy. It was an accident. Charlotte in Arlington Heights.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I think it looks like at least on paper, that Donald Trump won overwhelmingly. I'm looking at an article in the Epoch Times. Bellwether counties went overwhelmingly for Trump in 2020. There are 19 counties across the nation, and with the exception of one in Washington, the average was a 16-point victory for Donald Trump. Amazing. I mean, there are a couple, few in Wisconsin, one in Indiana and Ohio and Maine and Vermont.
Well,
what do you think of that?
Yeah, we went through that. Thanks for the call, Charlotte. And those bellwether counties that have stood up for election cycles going back to 1984, if I'm recalling correctly. And it was anomalous that somebody would lose 15 of the 16 and still win the presidency. That was the case with Joe Biden. But you have to say again, those are just bellwether counties. That's not the sum total of the vote, obviously. And statistical anomalies occur. It's just a very curious thing that most of the statistical anomalies that we've seen from the 2020 election redound to the benefit of Joe Biden, which is in itself a statistical anomaly. So, yeah, that's one of them for sure. Hazel and Round Lake.
Yes, good morning, Dan and Amy. I love your show, by the way. Okay, what I would do if it just say it gets to the point where he wants to speak to everyone and say he's kind of stepping aside or whatever, I would first address the nation as the people, and I would talk about the things that we've accomplished together and the respect that he has had just being your president and the gratitude he's had and how much he loves our country. And so I would go with that, and then if he wants to list some things, he can, you know, individually. But it would be more to the people directly to say, you know, it's been what he's got out of it as the president himself.
Hazel, you and I are on the same wavelength. Thanks for the call, because that's sort of the outline in terms of structure of the remarks that I wrote that nobody wants to hear, and that's fine.
No.
You know,
we listen
to the Dan Prof show. You listen to my show, where I just, you know, basically talk to myself in a closet, and then you can hear it there. Cause it's fine. Everybody gets
their say. We have a podcast of it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Go to 560theanswer.com.
Yeah.
We'll hear your answer. Real quick, I just found this out. Lightfoot and Dr. Awardi are having a press conference, and I hope to God they do not dress up as a pilgrim and a turkey.
Was this after their lunch at Chicago Cut?
Yeah.
Knock back a couple of scotches, have a smoke.
Grab some newspapers before you go to the bathroom. Yeah.
Are these two for real? Lee and Hammond.
Yeah, hi, guys. Hey, as far as Donald Trump's parting remarks, he's got nothing to lose at this point. They're never going to say anything good about him in the press. So what he should do, unlike what Eisenhower did, dance around the subject, just tell the American people who's behind the deep state, what their motivations are, and what they intend to do. He's got nothing to lose at this point, and they're going to vilify him. I don't care what he says. So he might as well just come clean with the American people and tell them what it's all about.
That's interesting. Thanks for the call, Lee. No abstract military-industrial complex. Name names. Sean in Elmwood Park.
Oh, Sean.
Hello. Listen, you know that lady Dawn that called that wants to take to the streets? She's twice the man Lori Lightfoot in her costume pretends to be. I'll tell you that right now. With that Herman Munster husband, wife, whatever. It's a freak show down in Chicago. And now you're going to pay 3 cents an extra for a gallon of gas and your taxes are going up. Stay there, I dare you, dummy prop. By the way, how's that house doing? Huh? With the water and back and the dolphins. You love it, don't you?
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
As far as Trump, I want him to do an Al Pacino in Injustice for All at the end of it. And say,
everybody's
and for the rest
out of order.
Of you, everybody's out of order. You cheated me, you son of a guns. And the GOP, you're going to ask me for money? You're lucky I don't kick your door in every day and take your money. Scumbags. So no money to the GOP. And we go to Florida and secede. Croft, I live in your house for a little while. We straighten it all out.
I'm living in the house. What?
I look forward to that. That's going to be a reality TV show if the two of you come down.
Oh, that'll be fun.
All right, we close out the week before
Chuck.
The holiday with the dance and feed of Chuck from Delavan.
Chuck, I'm thankful
hey,
for you.
You're not going to believe this. I actually got through you on the first call, first time. It normally takes 3 phones and 100 times to get through. Talking to myself in a closet was my garage band's name, by the way, Dan.
Is that
thank
right,
you.
Talking Heads cover band? Go ahead.
Yeah, yes, it was. Hey, there is no concession speech. And everybody here that it's in your listening audience is going to have a very, very good Thanksgiving. In a couple weeks, this is all going to get straightened out. So you guys have a nice, and thank you for letting me be who I am and being a part of your show. I don't know how I ended up in this last time slot, but thank you very much, and God bless everybody, and God bless America.
Thank you, Dance and Chuck from Delavan. Have a happy Thanksgiving and end on that optimistic note.
Yeah, and I will tweet that video out of us dancing. It did happen.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.